Renee Rodman, it's a name that inspires confidence here at Audio Gals. Narrating since 2006, Renee has around 300 audiobooks to her name, and when we see a romance with her name attached, well, we just get a little excited. We know it will be the highest quality when it comes to both the performance and production. She's the voice of some of our favorites, including Ilona Andrews, Kate Daniels, and the Edge series, as well as Lisa Kleypas's Blue Eyed Devil and Jennifer Cruzy's Manhunting. Welcome, Renee. We're so glad to have you with us today, or I should say this week, as we have a week full of Renee Rodman events and giveaways planned over the next 5 days.
Oh, thank you, Leah. I am so excited to be here. This is really an honor and a pleasure. And I think what Audio Gals has done for the romance audio community is amazing. So it's really exciting to be a part of this.
Well, thank you. I know your love of recording started at a very early age. I think you were 7 years old, and that carried into adolescence and adulthood prior to your career as a professional narrator.
Well, it's all my parents' fault. They bought me a tape recorder for Christmas one year, and I loved that thing. Interestingly enough, I couldn't stand the sound of my own voice, but I loved to take it around the house and find different acoustics, and I found that the bathroom was the best place to record, and I would bring home all the stories I learned in school and would record all the different characters, and I was obsessed with it. And then I became obsessed with radio dramas and audiobooks, but it never occurred to me to ever do it. But I loved playing with it.
Well, can you tell our listeners about your acting background?
You know, I actually started acting pretty late in life compared to most people. I think most people start in their teens or early 20s. And I would never listen to that voice deep inside me that was wanting to be an actor. It was buried very deep. And I always thought of myself as going into business of some sort. And I just kept pursuing business through college, although I would take these peripheral classes and something like theater lighting or props, which made no sense because that wasn't even interesting to me, but I would sit there and watch the actors on stage. And ultimately, I ended up in advertising and marketing, and I was an executive. I rose up the ranks very quickly. And then in 89, I bought a VCR. I was a little behind the times. I bought a VCR, and there was a mom and pop video shop nearby. And every 10th video, I got one free. And at the end of a month, I was getting my second free video, and the pop of the mom and pop said, "You're not dating much, are you?" I looked at him and I thought, what am I doing? This is my 20th video in a month. And I just would sit there and watch these videos. And there was this burning excitement inside me. And I was living in Michigan at the time. And I just sat down. I turned off the television. I thought to myself, what is going on in me? And I realized all the videos I was renting were things that maybe I could have played. And I thought, boy, am I going to admit this out loud after all these years that I have this dream to be an actor? And I never wanted to be famous. It was more about the act of being an actor, doing all that work and being allowed to have all these feelings and emotions and being paid for it. And so it was within a week and a half after that I made a plan. I decided to go to LA, interview with ad agencies out there, talk to people in the business, and find out if I could, you know, make a go of it at, I think, 26 or 27. And I did. I flew out. I interviewed with all these ad agencies. I never expected at the end of a week and a half to go home with 11 jobs. I had 50 interviews and I think 3 or 4 offers. And that allowed me to move out and, you know, take acting classes. I got advice from a big agent out here, which I wanted nothing from him other than advice. And he gave me every step that he would do if he were pursuing it, which I did. And I had a home, a job, and I was in acting class within 1 month of recognizing that I had a 20th movie I had watched in a row. And so that was within a month. And I moved out and began taking acting classes. And I had so much support from family and friends. And I knew no one here, but I knew I was in the right place. It was just this fire in me that exploded. And I loved taking classes and I loved learning what made a great actor. And I used my business acumen as well, which I think helped me, remember that I'm a commodity. It's that I couldn't take everything personally. So that's how I got my start.
Well, and you have acted in TV and soap operas, is that correct? Or any others? Did you ever perform on stage?
Oh, I did. Yeah, I had quite a few plays I had done on stage. I did do film, television, videos, a little bit of everything. Again, using my business side, I figured I should be as diverse as possible and, you know, not just rely on one area. Because the people that I saw that were successful and had longevity in the business could do a lot of different things. They just didn't do one element. And so I got into, even voiceover then wasn't on my radar, but it sort of knocked on my door and I took advantage of it a little bit at a time, radio commercials, TV commercials. And then it led into cartoons, video games, and went from there.
Ah. So how did you get started in narrating?
Well, as I said, I was always obsessed with audiobooks. I would go buy or rent audiobooks, almost like I was renting those movies years ago. you know what? I'm just seeing a pattern here. And my sister, she knew Scott Brick. And Scott Brick, which I bet many of your listeners know, who was the end all be all male narrator, you know, especially at that time. He was just the cat's meow when it came to audiobooks. Well, I'd walked into my house, and at the time, I think I was on one or two soap operas and, you know, had a great amount of success in my own right. But when I walked in and my sister told me what he did, I sat right on the living room floor and I peppered him with questions, not even in my own gut, really thinking I was going to maybe try to go down this path. I was just so taken with the fact that here in my living room was an audiobook narrator. And I asked him a million questions and he just kept answering them. And I said, well, I agreed to trade information. I said, you'd be great in car commercials. And with that voice, so I said, I'll give you information on the commercial side if you'll maybe give me some information on the audiobook side. And it was as though I had found the end of the rainbow and the pot of gold in terms of my heart's desire. It was a really great day. And Scott, he said, really? You really? This is something? I said, yeah. And I said, would you? So I traded favors with people. I got studio time. I said, Scott, would you consider directing my 3X, my demo reel? From 3X, he said, well, I would do a bio, I would do a male-female scene, and I would do, I think there was young adult. I said, great. He agreed to come in and direct me in all three of those, and I had never tried narrating before that moment in the studio with him, other than practicing those three, that demo. And I said, okay, now what? And he said, I have to say, I've never known anyone to take all my advice before. He goes, this is a little unnerving. I said, this is awesome. And so he gave me the name of seven publishers. He said, well, try these seven. I said, can I use your name? He said, sure, you can use my name. I said, okay. So I sent out to all seven and I heard back from four, which was in our business of, you know, returns, that in the entertainment business, that was quite high. And within about a month, I think I had a Tantor home studio and I had begun recording for Random House as well as Brilliance Audio. I thought I died and gone to heaven. It was a pretty, pretty amazing transition for sure. And I never expected it to be my full career. But once it started and started rolling, I mean, I was getting paid to read. Oh, boy, it was that and perform, you know, that in this capacity. And within about a year and a half to 2 years, I had to make a decision about leaving some other elements of my entertainment career, or at least pushing them off to the side for a while.
Mm-hmm. You shared with me earlier that you were a romance and mystery reader before you started narrating. I guess that's when you had time to read merely for pleasure. I can't help but wonder if that isn't one of the reasons you are so effective at narrating romance. Do you think that gives you a better understanding of what romance listeners want to hear?
Well, I'm not sure I would say I'm confident in saying I'm giving romance listeners what they want to hear. But when I would read romance, I loved the details and the myriad emotions that the novel or story would take me through. And so when I narrate, this may be selfish, but I give what I would want to hear. And, you know, focusing in on that, those transitions from just meeting someone to the dance of figuring out if this is a relationship that's going to move forward, I guess essentially is I just fall in love. I get to fall in love all over again. Who doesn't want to do that, right? That's why we read romance in the first place. And so with each book, I get to do that dance again and again, and it's such a wonderful feeling. And it keeps things fresh here at home, too. But it makes me always feel, I get to feel all those things every time I narrate. And so because those moments, those stepping stone moments are important to me as a reader, they're important to me as a narrator. And it's what makes me excited to do this kind of book. So as I, Renee, follow that through in the relationship throughout the novel, that's just where the narration comes from. So I'm not sure if it's everyone's cup of tea, but it's what I would want to hear and what I enjoy moving through.
Well, I want to take a minute and explain to our listeners that I will occasionally refer to comments you made, Renee, in the Narrators Forum I hosted over at Speaking of Audiobooks in November of 2011. You, along with Tavia Gilbert, Phil Gigante, Karen White, Justine Eyre, and Eggsy Sands, discussed pertinent issues in your industry, as well as giving us listeners a glimpse into your world of bringing multiple characters to life for our entertainment. It was a 2+ hour live chat, followed by discussion with listeners. That was an exciting opportunity for not just romance listeners, but listeners in general to better understand your profession. And listeners, you can find a link to this forum beneath today's chat. In the Narrators Forum, Renee, you talked about the more subtle type of narration versus the more dramatic. Where do you fall on that scale, and what do you think about listeners' preferences for one or the other?
Well, I have to be honest, when I started in this industry, I didn't know there was more than one way to do things, one way of narration. I only knew to fully act out. I approached my narration just like I approached my acting, as well as I approached voiceover, whether it be, you know, cartoons, commercials, video games. And so I just committed fully to it. So I would say I fall more on the dramatic side of the narration. And not till later on, and quite frankly, seeing reviews and all, did I see that there was, you know, a variety of ways to tell a story, that, you know, some people did it more subtle and others fully acted it out. And I started to question whether or not fully acting it out was a good choice, because I recognized that it wasn't everybody's cup of tea. But then I thought, you know, it's okay that there's more than one way to skin a cat, and that not everybody likes what I might do, because there might be some who do, and that's who I'm going to perform for. So I wasn't going to change how I'd grown up and what I'd learned for years. That's not to say that I haven't made subtle changes throughout my narration and learning more about the process and technique, etc. But I would definitely say I fall on the more dramatic side. I really have a goal of making a movie in your mind. And I find that narration, when you first listen to an audiobook, when you first pop the CD in, or used to be cassette, or turn your iPod on, you only have that one sense. You know, there's only your ears. You don't get your eyes. You don't get smells. And it's just one sense, and it takes a lot of concentration. And so to get that ball rolling, I think you have to start out a little slower. But by the end, I want them to forget that there's one person, that they see these characters in their mind just like I do. So that's my goal. And so if we want to call that more dramatic, I'm happy with that. Like I said, even though I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, it's what makes me happy and hopefully others, especially when we're in some of these more otherworldly type mm-hmm. books, you know.
I know it's my cup of tea. I prefer what I would say more drama, more acting. Whenever I get to the more subtle narrations, my mind tends to wander more. You mentioned in that forum a few methods you utilize to improve your performance when narrating. I'd like to ask about two of those specifically. Can you explain to our listeners what you do when it's time for the chase, the high drama sections of the book, and then the reading or writing of a letter?
When I first started taking acting, I learned that our brains don't necessarily want to go to those places that are necessary. Our brains don't want to feel pain. Our brains don't want to do a lot of work, just in general. And they sort of resist wanting to feel these extremes. So, I had a wonderful acting coach. His name was Roy London. The people in my class were Sharon Stone, Brad Pitt, Matthew Perry. He really was a fantastic acting teacher. And he would say, look, it's not going to, your brain's not going to go there naturally. So you have to put it in your body first, and your brain will follow. And I think that's, quite frankly, how life is done. So when I'm in the studio and I can't move, it's difficult. I don't know if difficult, but it's not as easy to make the high tension moments or certain moments as, like I said, movie of the mind, if I can't move. So, for example, when the chase scene starts, and I don't even think about this anymore, it's just natural. I raise my hands up, palms out, in an almost, if there was an umpire, I mean, not an umpire, a referee at a football game, and he'd go, score, right? How they raise their hands up like that. Well, mine's palms out and almost in a V formation, and it creates tension in my body, because it's hard to hold your hands up like that for so long. But since I can't move, I feel like I need to do something that puts me on high alert. So I put those arms up in the air. I don't move against my, you know, there's no shirts rubbing against the microphone. Because when you're doing a movie, there's all sorts of things, physical things that you can do that create tension, and it happens more naturally. So I raise those arms up, and my eyes are wide open, and every fiber in my body is on the edge, which is usually where my character is. So that's how I create tension. And when I write a letter or I'm reading a diary, I actually put a pencil, not real pencil, but a fake pencil in my hand, and I write it out. And because I want it to be as though it's actually happening, that you're not just hearing words on a page. And so I might write, "Dear Audio Gals, I want to thank you for this opportunity," period. And all I'm doing is writing up in the air, mm-hmm. but I just feel like it gives a more real feel to it. And so sometimes I just have to find ways to get my body to do things so that it comes out on the microphone. Right. I don't know if everybody does that, but that's just something that I do.
Well, it's effective. I can tell you that letter writing in the air. Of course, I had heard your touchdown V sort of thing has stuck with me since that narrator's forum, but that letter writing is very effective.
Well, you know, when I teach, I've taught several, I used to teach acting, and then I've been asked to Pat Fraley's classes to teach, be a guest teacher in several of his audiobook narration classes. And students, when they would narrate and it'd be this huge dramatic scene, it was just falling flat. And so I would say, just for fun, put your arms up in the air, put them straight up in the, you know, I'd do things that would make them uncomfortable. And then all of a sudden things, their narration came alive. Or when writing a letter is usually, or reading a diary is usually really intimate. Mm-hmm. And in order to get that intimacy, I would say, just take your hand and write and, you know, act as though you're writing it, or follow along. If you're reading a diary, put your finger underneath and see it. Dear diary, I had, you know, and it just came alive. So it seems to work for others, you know.
Well, let's talk a few minutes about your narration of Blue Eyed Devil by Lisa Kleypas. It's still a popular contemporary romance audiobook today, even though it was recorded in 2008. Why do you think Blue Eyed Devil captures the hearts of so many listeners?
Well, obviously, Lisa is a extremely talented writer, but I think what makes that book different, at least for me, it was a powerful book for me, is when we read romance, we do it as an, I believe we like it. One of the reasons is because it's an escape, and we suspend belief and we get to live in this other world in which we get to experience all those great feelings with our main character in the book. But I think what happens in Blue Eyed Devil is, besides have being a pretty fantastic romance, there's an element of realism that's added in the lead gal, Haven, in her character. And she has some emotional wounds that I don't think are often dealt with in romance, at least not on that level where we experience how someone attempts to overcome their past in such a real and powerful way.
In January of 2010, over at Speaking of Audiobooks, I wrote a column titled Heart-Wrenching Narrations. I opened with my thoughts on your narration of Blue Eyed Devil. It's a book I graded a B+ over at All About Romance in print format. I found it difficult to identify with the heroine, Haven, even though I thought she was a sympathetic character. But when I later listened, your performance took me to another whole level entirely. Here's part of what I wrote then. I started seeing and hearing the character of Haven as portrayed by narrator Renee Rodman in an entirely new light, one that greatly moved my heart. Listening to Haven talk when she could hardly form words engaged me emotionally in a manner far deeper than the mere reading. Once her physical wounds were healed, I continued empathizing with this woman who was in need of emotional and mental healing as well. I heard, rather than read, her hesitancy with Hardy. I heard her fears and vulnerability. I heard her gaining much-needed confidence on the job. As Blue Eyed Devil evolved more into Haven's story than Hardy's, my grade for the audio version came in at a solid A.
Wow.
You know, Renee, I'm not alone in believing that you improved an already great book with your performance. Although you commented in the narrator's forum that narrators are simply the vehicle for telling the story, can you expand on what you believe that you as a narrator, or any narrator for that matter, can bring to the story above and beyond delivering the author's words?
Well, you know, when I made that comment back in the narrator's forum, I don't think I did a very good job of describing what I meant, because when I said something about being a vehicle, it seemed to raise a lot of eyebrows. And to clarify what I meant, unlike a film or an adaptation of a book to film manuscript, you know, you have actors and directors and producers, and they're all collaborating to figure out how to tell this story. And as a female actor in the film, I just have one little part in bringing that story to life. But when I narrate an audiobook, not only do I not paraphrase or change wording based on what the scene might be in the for the movie version, it's important to get every word out there that the author wrote. But it's but I'm the sole vehicle for that whole storytelling experience. So first of all, I just wanted to clarify that I didn't mean that I'm just a vehicle for relaying the author's words, but rather I'm the only vehicle. You know, there's just this one way to get this story out and have it be lived emotionally, et cetera, as the author would hopes it would be, I assume. But what I think, what I try to do with characters in the book, and this is the same as on film and television, and this again goes back to my acting days, is that I try to never judge a character. I try to see through the character's back door. And what I mean by that is nobody sets out in the world. I don't care if it's, you know, on a ridiculous end, Jeffrey Dahmer, or if it's Mother Teresa. Neither one of them, Mother Teresa just didn't wake up one day and say, I want to be looked at as a saint. And Jeffrey Dahmer didn't wake up one day and go, I want everyone to think of me as the most gruesome killer ever. They didn't go out in the world that way. They go out in the world and they're, you know, whether or not their brain works like ours, and we would, now do I judge these people as another person living in our country on our earth? Absolutely. Meaning, do I think what he did was bad? Yes. But if you're going to ask me to play a variety of roles in which I might play the murderer or the heroine or the bad guy, etc., I get into a lot of trouble if I say, oh, this guy's a bad guy and I'm going to play him like a bad guy. Well, that man never set out to be a bad guy. He set out to, I don't know, get revenge for his family. I can't start out looking at him going, he's this bad murderer guy. I have to find out why he did what he did, or make choices as to why I have to do this. And that goes into what we call goal. If I was teaching acting, it's goal, action, and obstacle. Every character, if it's any fun to watch or listen to or read, has something they want out of life, a goal. Mm-hmm. If they didn't, it would be a pretty boring movie, book, etc. Mm-hmm. And there's got to be a reason why they can't get it. That's the obstacle. And then the action is, well, how are they going to get it? So, you know, for Haven, she wanted love, but her obstacle was she believed she was unworthy. And her action was to, you know, how was she going to overcome it? Well, she was going to make those men, you know, Hardy, she was going to make him prove to her that he wasn't going to leave her. So I try to approach all the characters in that way. What are they? They don't think they're bad or good or ugly or they're just trying to figure out how to get what they want in life. And so that's how I choose to approach those characters. Right. With that goal, action, and obstacle. And it used to be when I first started in acting, no matter what role it was, I would write that out. I would sit down, turn my script over, and write down what's my character's goal, what's the... I don't have to do that anymore. It's sort of second nature. Mm-hmm. But that's how I choose to approach those things.
All right.
Listeners, we're ending part one of Renee's talk at this point, and tomorrow on Tuesday, we'll feature part two. There's much more to hear from Renee as I talk with her about the secret of performing those highly desirable heroes, her preparation and recording process, and Ilona Andrews' Kate Daniels and the Edge series from her perspective, among other things.